Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Mitchell Towner, an assistant professor of finance at the University of Arizona, and, by the way, a few weeks ago won the World Series of Poker $1,500 buy-in Monster Stack No Limit Hold'em tournament for some $1.1 million. That's more than Richard and I make in a week. Mitch Towner, welcome to Gambling with an Itch.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Before we get to Mitch, our new website, gamblingwithanedge.com, is up and running. Still beta test, but up and running. We've had several comments on last week's show. Others of you are still asking questions at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Thank you. Keep it up.
Yeah, you can also ask at facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can always tweet them at me at rwm21.
For those of you who want to see how the U.S. elections are affecting betting markets, we have some news out of William Hill in England. Richard, what's happened?
I don't know. Well, I guess it has something to do with the elections. So the odds on, they have a bet on whether there will be a major announcement by a world leader on contact with aliens in the year 2016. And the odds have dropped from 1,000 to 1 to 25 to 1. So now normally you would think that means somebody has inside information.
Oh, I would think. That's a big drop.
I mean, Hillary Clinton has said that she wants to get to the bottom of this, right?
So, well, I don't know.
It seems to me at 25 to 1, if I had access to Betfair, I would love to go, you know, put up 30 to 1 and take the other side.
Yeah, but they actually limit it to 50 pounds.
50 pounds, yeah. Well, these are with the bookmakers, or with William Hill specifically, right? But on Betfair, you can put up a price on anything you want, right? So if you want to put up a price of, I will bet that aliens land on the White House lawn this year, you can put that up, and if somebody fills your order, great. I mean, you may not get filled.
And you're laying the yes at 30 to 1. How much of my action do you want?
No. I'm usually a don't better.
So. All right. So this actually is bad news for our guest. He just won $1 million, is looking for good places to invest his money, and so this means he lost one of his outs. Oh, well. Okay, Mitchell Towner, let's talk about your victory. And this victory actually gives you and me something in common. Neither one of us will ever be mentioned in the discussion for the best player never to win a World Series of Poker bracelet. Of course, the reasons are slightly different. You want a bracelet before almost anybody knew you could play a bit. And in my case, I have no poker skill whatsoever. But they're almost the same. Let's start with this year's win. It's a monster stack event. For those listeners who aren't that knowledgeable about poker tournament, what's the difference between a monster stack no limit hold'em event and a no limit hold'em event that isn't otherwise qualified?
So a monster stack tournament, you have more starting chips, and this is all relative to the big blind. And when you have more big blinds in your starting stack, that allows you to do more flexible things. So you can play more hands. It's less likely that you're going to have to go all in right away and lose the tournament. And so you could just sort of really be patient and play for hours at a time with very little risk of going broke if you play appropriately.
And is that why you selected the Monster Stack, or what made you choose that particular event?
That was really, really appealing to me. So that was definitely a factor. I also have other professional engagements. So I lucked out in that we had a big conference in Park City, Utah, the 3 days before the Monster Stack tournament was going to start. And so it made just a lot of sense for me to fly from Tucson up to Salt Lake City, go to the conference, go straight from the conference back to Vegas, and then I could play in this Monster Stack tournament. But yeah, I was trying to target one tournament this summer, and if I could play any one tournament, like, this would be the one tournament. And so it really worked out.
So if the Monster Stack had not been on those particular dates, would you have selected a different tournament to play in?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would have had to figure it out if I want to do two flights, or if I just would have, you know, it just depends on how busy my summer was. I didn't go further than that just because it worked out so perfectly.
And do you play a lot of poker back in Tucson, or?
No, really, not at all. I think that's what some people really enjoyed about the story is this was like my first ever recorded cash in a tournament. I used to play a lot of poker when I was in high school and college, a lot of cash games, some underground games, some online. But that was mostly just cash games. And then in the last 7 years, I've been in grad school and starting work as an assistant professor. So I've been really busy. And so I can only play about once a year. I'll come to Vegas for a couple of days, play some cash games for, those couple of days. And that's about all the poker I play.
Wow. So have you played many tournaments prior to this?
Not very many. I played one 1500 World Series of Poker event 3 years ago. I played like one $300 tournament in Florida maybe 2 years ago. And then I've played like some $100 tournaments when I'm, either in Vegas or back when I was in college, like in these underground things. But I probably played a total of 8 to 10 tournaments in my entire life.
It's a pretty amazing story. Well, so what did you do to prepare? Were there any particular books or what?
He went to Salt Lake City.
The poker mecca.
Yeah. So even though I don't get the opportunity to play, I try and study fairly consistently. So there's some really good, I think. Well, so first of all, when I started back in like high school and college, there were some classic books that I read and I thought really helped me. Everything from, Super System by Doyle Brunson, maybe the most famous poker book in the world. Patrick Antonios has a book where he literally kept a mic with him and through an entire tournament in the Aussie Millions. He would remember what cards he had and what the action was. And so basically you can like watch him play the entire tournament by reading the book. There's some other books that I read that were like advanced tournament strategies where you sort of got three young professionals that play online and they all have different styles. And so you could read through and sort of, there's an example, 10 hands where you could see how they would handle each of these different situations. And so poker, it is a style type thing. And so you got to sort of make play however makes sense to you. And so I could steal different elements from all these different players.
Was that book Razor's Edge?
No, I think it's literally called Advanced Tournament Poker Strategies. There's three volumes. And then recently, so that was all sort of college time is when I read these books. And then recently, I think the European Poker Tours, they have a TV show that they play about once a week. They go on hiatus at different times. But I think the commentators there do a really, really good job sort of describing the hands. And you can see what these top European pros are playing and sort of the size of their bets and what kind of hands they're playing in what kind of situations. I think that's really, really useful to learn. And then the last thing that I want to shout out is I have two friends from college who are professional poker players up in Portland. And they have a really, really, really good podcast. It's called The Breakdown by the Poker Guys. And they spend about 30 minutes to an hour once a week just choosing one famous hand from televised poker and just talking through every single minute detail and just going into like all sorts of hypotheticals. And it really, I think listening to them has helped me a lot.
So 30 minutes about one single hand.
Yeah. So, if you think about poker, right, there's pre-flop and then there's the three straight. So, maybe if it's a heads up pot, they're maybe making 8 decisions. And so they're talking about every decision that they make I think the average podcast is closer to 40 minutes or something. Yeah. So 5 minutes on every single decision, which is pretty cool.
All right. Now, given that you were among the least experienced people poker-wise in the event, what strategic decisions did you make that perhaps you wouldn't make if you had had a ton of experience?
So I would say that early on in the tournament, you still get a bunch of amateurs that I felt very comfortable playing with. I thought I might have had a skill edge against some of these amateur players, and so I was very comfortable playing, hands against them and post-flop. When I got later in the tournament, and this sort of happens when you have a shorter stack anyways, you can't splash around as much. I was trying to avoid marginal spots against some of these professionals. So there's some professionals that are likely to call you in position, and it's really, really hard to play poker when you're out of position against someone who's really dangerous and can do lots of tricky things. And so whenever I was in a situation where I had, even ace-jack offsuit under the gun, I might just fold it straight away if I know that the person who's on the button is likely to call with a wide range of hands, because then I feel like I'm going to get outplayed. And so maybe it's a small mistake to fold that hand, or maybe there's like a small amount of positive expected value by playing that hand. But I don't want to get in a tricky spot for my tournament life. And so with hour-long levels, I mean, I literally played 40 hours of poker in this tournament, which is crazy. I've never played longer in a tournament than about 3 hours. So when you have 40 hours...
How many days is that?
It was 4 days. Well, they had day 1A and day 1B. So I played day 1A, then I had a day off, and then it was 2, 3, 4, 10 hours a day. But yeah, so I thought with how deep the structure was, going back to the monster stack element, that you could just sort of fold, live another day, and wait until you have a better spot. And so that was sort of how I tried to play against these very experienced professionals.
So were you trying, was your strategy going in, I'm going to avoid getting into really big pots with pros, and I'll try to target the...
Well, in general, I don't really want to be in big pots in general, unless you have like aces or something. So I don't like to 3-bet much. I like to just sort of play in position, you know, a lot of calling, a lot of post-flop, just sort of maneuvering and read if someone is strong or weak. And being in position is just so huge on all these hands. So I didn't want to play big pots. Of course, by the time I got to the final table, you're down to 14 big blinds. You have to, you know, really the only thing you can do is sort of go all in or fold. And that's another way to mitigate any advantage that some professional would have on me. If I'm all in, you know, they can't outplay me.
Now, did other than the final table where it was fold or all in, did your strategy change over the tournament as your skill level and experience increased? Now, certainly with respect to the blinds and your size pot, those changes have to be made. But other than from your experience level, you got a hell of a lot of experience in this tournament compared to what you had before.
Oh, for sure. It's interesting. I think this is true of a lot of players that have won major tournaments, is they become much better players after they win the tournament than before the tournament, just because you learn so much by going through it and you relive it. And, you know, it's almost impossible not to get like just much better by going deep in a tournament. Some of the things,
and much richer too.
I guess I just felt more comfortable playing post flop, even like calling from the big blind later on in the tournament. At first, I was, you know, I guess I'm a little bit contradicting myself, but I wanted to avoid marginal spots that could become big hands. But when I'm closing the action, and it's, you know, it's one more big blind for me to call, then I was happy to take a flop and then trust my reads a little bit if I want to call down a couple of streets or just give up that, you know, that one big blind. So that was one thing I felt more comfortable with later on.
Were there any aha moments or kind of epiphanies where you said, oh, I think I got this, or something changed, or?
I had a couple of fun hands on. So to be honest, day one started out pretty nervous. Wasn't getting a ton of cards, was just trying to be patient. And there were a couple of, you know, young foreign pros that were trying to run over the table. And I made a couple of little moves to try and just steal a couple of chips back. And fortunately for me, they worked. And that really, I think, sort of gave me more confidence going forward at that point that, you know, it's all the same game. You know, they're not reading when I like did a bluff, so I can just go ahead and like play how I think
they
is
can't
best.
Read my mind.
Exactly. So yeah, like one of the situations was actually probably the craziest hand of the tournament for me. Was I was in the big blind with the 3-4 of hearts, and there was this aggressive Portuguese pro that was raising a whole bunch of different pots, and he raised and someone else in position called. And I called with 3-4 of hearts.
In the big blind.
In the big blind.
Wow.
And we're pretty deep. We have 80 big blinds. So it's not like I couldn't afford to do this, you know, if I'm 25 big blinds deep or something. Or maybe even 25, you maybe can. But I was deep enough that it was totally fine. And the flop came 7-7-3. Great flop for my hand, obviously. And I just played in flow and checked. And he fired again. And the person in position folded. So I thought I had a pretty easy just call. You know, it's hard to have an overpair here. Or a 7. So I just called. The turn came a 6. And I checked again and he fired. And I thought that he could be firing two straights with still air. Plus now I have the gut shot straight draw to the five. And it's relatively small. My three might be good. And so I decided to call again. And then the river came a 10. And I checked again. And he studied me for a long time and just like had this nervous look to him. And what I thought was going on was I thought he had like aces or kings or queens and thought that it would be wimpy to check behind, but he was also aware that there was, you know, two sevens on the board and that I could easily have a seven given that I call from the big blind. And so he finally made like a sort of a smallish bet. And that was my read on the situation. And so I decided to turn my hand into a bluff, thinking it looks so strong when I check raise here. And so I check raised and he's still getting, you know, 2-1 or 3-1 on calling. And he actually showed me a seven and folded, which is absolutely crazy. Like I was trying to get him to fold queens, but I didn't think there was any day in the world he would fold a seven, which maybe was just, he didn't think there was any way I could ever be bluffing here. He said something about the turn. So maybe he thought I had tens or I don't know. I don't know what his thought process was, but I couldn't believe he showed me the seven and folded. That was the craziest hand of the turn probably.
Huh. Good thing he
if he's listening to this, he's puking now.
Good thing he didn't show you the other seven, too. That would have really been a surprise. Okay. So before we conclude that this is simply a case of beginner's luck, you've played in a number of other games at a high level, including Magic the Gathering. What kind of success have you had at that game?
So in 2016, there was a junior tournament. So you had to be, when you qualified, you had to be under 16. And then by the time the World Championships came around, it was 16.
Wait, you just said 2016.
Sorry, 2003, I was 16. Excuse me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I qualified when I was 15. And then that summer, when I was 16, there was, it's called the Junior Super Series. And I won that tournament. There was, first of all, you had to qualify at the local level, so be in the top two. And then there were like 400 or 500 people in that tournament, and I won that entire tournament for a $20,000 scholarship for college. And then I dabbled a little bit more in some of the open events, not just like the junior events, and was pretty frustrated with the convex payout structure of the tournaments and how pretty much all the really good players were playing similar decks, and then it seemed like to me that it was came down to a lot of luck to not even cover your expenses versus get lucky like I did and win $20,000 in a weekend. And so I was frustrated with that and was enjoying poker more. And so I sort of transitioned away from Magic at that point.
So in the book, Johnny Magic and the Card Shark Kids, they sort of made a big deal of this idea of the Olympics of the mind, that the Magic players thought that playing this game was the Olympics of the mind and that it should transition easily into poker, that they would just come and dominate. And actually the Magic players seem to have done really well at poker. And so do you think that, do you think it's a good training ground?
Yeah, I think the results speak for themselves. Scott Sievers, one, like arguably the best poker player in the world. And he's a former Magic player, David Williams. I mean, I could list a ton of players. Actually, the guy that I beat in the final of the junior tournament that I played is a guy by the name of Sam Stein, who has millions of earnings. I always would joke with my friends when I was in grad school. It's like, oh, yeah, that's the guy that I beat in the Magic tournament. And I'd like show like career earnings for for Sam. Yeah. And I was like, I think I chose the wrong career.
We had John Finkel on the show 9 months ago or so. He's probably the best known, most successful Magic player. Have you ever played with or against John?
I unfortunately have not. So
he's playing poker now too, though, right?
So I've never even actually met him. I remember watching, I think there was a 1998 either national championship or world championship video. That was the first time I'd ever seen like Magic the Gathering on video, and I remember watching him. So that was a couple years before when I was playing seriously. And then I think he took a little hiatus when I was playing a little bit more seriously. But another one of the most famous, Magic players is Brian Kibler, friends with Brian. But yeah, I've never played against John, to answer your original question.
a lot of them also got into blackjack, and certainly you have a background in numbers. Have you gotten into that?
I haven't. There's so many things I like to do in life, and with grad school, and, you know, the fact that I can only set aside a couple of days a year to play poker, you know, I'd rather do poker than blackjack.
You don't get thrown out of the poker room, so that makes it a...
You can.
You can, yes.
The mutual friend who gave Richard and me your name said immediately after you won $1 million in the poker tournament, you drove to Los Angeles or somewhere and played in a fairly major bridge tournament where you also won. Sounds like a good week.
Yeah, it was a pretty crazy week. Flesh out that story a little bit more. The day three of the poker tournament was on Monday, and I had a flight out Monday evening thinking that, you know, with 7,000 entrants, that if I got to the top, you know, 100 players, I'd be happy to reschedule my flight. And so then I had three friends that we were going to play in the bridge tournament starting on Tuesday in LA, and ended up, getting all the way through day three, had to cancel my flight, stayed there. They had to find someone to fill in for me on the first day of the tournament. We played from the final 26 down to one, finished around midnight, did all a little celebration, some the winner's photos, all that stuff. It was obviously super wired and numb all over, and stayed up till 6:30 in the morning, went and caught a Southwest flight down to LAX. He picked me up from LAX. We walked, then we drove up and played in the second day of the tournament. Despite my delirious state, we managed to not only win that event that was the Tuesday-Wednesday event, but then we also won the main event that was Thursday-Friday. So 8 days I didn't lose anything. It was pretty lucky.
How serious a bridge player are you? I mean...
I spend more time doing bridge than any of these other games. Going back to, there's a lot of things I like to do. I was on the U.S. junior team, for 4 years in a row, and that is under 26 years old. Everything scales up in the bridge world, right, with the average age and everything. And I try and go to, they're called the North American, Bridge Championships or Nationals, but it's actually, international tournament, like all the top European pros come over and play in this, similar to like the World Series of Poker. There's three 10-day tournaments every year, one fall, one spring, and one summer. And so I try and go to probably one and a half of those. And then, you know, some other one-off random tournaments, like this tournament in LA was in preparation for the Summer National that's coming up in Washington, D.C. next week.
And are you going to that?
Yeah. So yeah. The guy that I was playing with in L.A., an iron, and we'll play in that.
Yeah. But there's no money in bridge.
Yeah, the economics of bridge are a little bit funky. With the exception of, you know, a handful of tournaments, the prizes are what they call master points, which is basically like a rating system, like an imaginary pigment that people can collect and never lose but have no cash value.
It's like Pokemon Go.
Yeah, basically, exactly. The top players do make money because there will be sponsors who will hire either a player or a team of players to either partner them or play on the team with them to play in the big tournaments. And so there's a lot of players that will either have full year-long contracts committed to play all three, you know, fall, summer, spring nationals. There's also arrangements that can be made where you can hire someone to play in like a 2-day tournament or something like that. So there are people that make a sizable living playing bridge, but yeah, you're correct that the tournaments don't actually give out cash prizes.
Well, I kind of grew up in a bridge and backgammon club. I was a backgammon player more than a bridge player. So there were certainly people who made pretty good money as bridge players, but they were playing cash games every day. And, you know, but that's a whole different lifestyle.
Yeah, that's another thing. And I mean, there still are money bridge games, but duplicate bridges, I think, become more and more dominant than the cash games.
Have they found a way to get younger people into the game? I mean, you're young, but it's one of those games that seems to be aging. And
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. Every year you look at the national membership and the ages, you know, the average age is increasing, which obviously is not sustainable. You know, there's a handful of areas that are doing nice things to attract younger people. There's a big club in the Bay Area where they've sort of been able to recruit a bunch of players. And once you get, you know, a handful of young players and it's a cool thing to do, then it's easier to get more and more. My bridge mentor taught a one-credit course at Rice University for the last couple of years to recruit some players.
Actually, that's a great idea. I mean, if they started putting courses in colleges, I bet you would get a lot more players.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I mean, it's whenever you see these top professional bridge players being interviewed, everyone's always like, what can we do to get more young people? I mean, that's on everyone's mind. And I think that there are some successful things. They're starting, you know, learn bridge in a day classes that you can, you know, drag some people down to. But I think the biggest, there's sort of two big problems in recruiting younger people to play bridge. Well, maybe three. It's the attention span. It takes, you know, a long time to play, or, you know, a full session of bridge. You have to sit at this table and not have your phone or do anything for 3.5 hours. The lack of cash prizes. So, you know, the people that are inclined towards games would rather go play poker than play bridge. And then I forget the third thing. I think just like, yeah, wanting to hang out with your friends, and if there aren't many other young people, then you're not going to be the one young person that goes.
Well, there are too many different, there are too many options now, too. I mean, you know, when I was young and I grew up outside Chicago in the winter, people played games and cards, and because it was cold as hell outside. And
hell isn't very cold.
Yeah, but now with the, you know, now you can go on your computer and you can, I don't know, just... just seems people are less inclined to do that kind of stuff.
Oh, and to piggyback, one other reason that it's sort of unappealing to some younger players is there's a big fixed cost to even get to the point where you can really play bridge. There's a lot of people that have played trump type games where, you know, euchre, you know,
spades.
Exactly. Something where the card play is, you know, they're familiar with the card play, but the bidding is a big hurdle to. A big fixed cost to learn before you can really play bridge. So that makes it hard too.
Now we've talked about three different card games that you've had some success in, bridge and poker and Magic, the Gathering. Now, how are they similar? How are they different?
There's a variety of things that are going to be important in all three games. So, you know, having a good understanding of probability, being able to, you know, just hold cards and be comfortable with cards and remember which cards have been played and are still coming, being able to look at your opponent and see if they feel comfortable or uncomfortable, all of those things are I think sort of necessary to be good at any kind of card game. I think Magic, there's a creativity element where you need to sort of design which 60 cards are the best cards to combine to make into a deck so you can bring it to the tournament, and those are the cards you're going to be playing to optimize against what other people are going to be doing in those 60 cards. Whereas, you know, poker and bridge, obviously it's the same 52 cards. You don't have to think about that sort of thing. But then you have a lot of degrees of freedom once you are in that setting. So with poker, your bet sizing, especially in No Limit, it can be anything you want, which I think is really, really important. You would think that in bridge, there isn't as many degrees of freedom, but there actually are, because you have the order that you play your 13 cards is can tell a completely different story to your partner or to the people you're playing against, and it can create all sorts of problems for them. And so just trying to, yeah, like different levels of creativity, either, you know, beforehand or afterwards. Yeah, I think, you know, having a poker face, being able to read someone else's poker face, probability and statistics, and just being comfortable with cards. Yeah.
Would you guess that most people with a high degree of success that all those games would score at the genius level on most tests?
Well, so there's so many different kinds of intelligence. I think that, yeah, like if you're just like doing the IQ quick problem solving type of, you know, genius, I would think that you'd get a lot of people on that spectrum. It would be interesting to see exact statistics on that, but I would think that those skills are related to that same sort of tests.
Now, you teach finance, so you must have studied a lot of economics along the way. That's my background. I've maintained for years that the applied logic they teach you in economics helps prepare you for the applied logic of successful gambling. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. It goes back to some of the same skills that we were mentioning. Go back to probability. Game theory, having just logic, like being able to prove something or being able to, you know, it doesn't sound super complicated, but, you know, putting yourself in a position where you're unlikely to win at something. But if you, given that you're already in the situation, what is the best way to maximize your chance of winning this way? So, you know, to like bring up magic, you might be like, okay, well, I need to draw this card in the next three turns, otherwise I'm going to lose. And so then what, you know, the logic that you have to apply and what this is, you know, in economics or anything is, okay, so let's assume that I'm going to get it in these next three cards.
Now what?
Yeah, now what? Now what's the best way to
maximize,
you know, conditional on it being in the next card or in two cards or in three cards. And it's the same thing, like, so my undergrad degree was in math and econ, proof-based classes, and just having that sort of logic, I think, is really useful too. I think all those skills are very similar.
Do you think you'll stay in academic, or with this win, it could certainly propel you into many other different things?
No, I really enjoy my job. Definitely be back teaching in the fall. I think I'll probably take a few more shots at poker tournaments. There's some tax incentives for me to do that because I can offset losses and gains, especially this year. But I really enjoy my job and plan on going back and working,
making a career of teaching.
Yeah, and research. So majority of my job
of research
is research.
Are you doing or interested in doing?
So I'm in empirical corporate finance. So this is like basically applied microeconomics, trying to test different theories in terms of, you know, corporate governance, how firms operate. My dissertation did this corporate governance in a healthcare setting, trying to tackle, you know, old questions using a new way. I have a whole bunch of, you know, random interests in finance that I'm still relatively new in my job, and so got to flesh out the papers, but those are some of the things that interest me.
Now, we're posting the show on Thursday, and we're taping it 2 days early on Tuesday. Now, as we're taping this, day 2A and 2B of the World Series of Poker main event are taking place. I'm assuming you think you can afford the $10,000 entry fee. So, did you enter on day 1C, and are you still alive?
Yeah, so we were joking when we bought into the... I had a buddy who's a finance professor at the University of Texas, and we both came down here to play in the Monster Stack. And we were joking when we started the tournament, what place would we have to get for us to then be able to justify coming back and playing in the main event? And I said, you know, if I made like $50,000, I think I would come back next year. Like, I'd set aside $10,000 and come back, just because with this bridge tournament coming up, already being gone, you know, for this poker tournament already. I had like a family vacation this summer. I didn't feel like I was working nearly hard enough during the summer, and that I really need to be back in the office grinding on the research. But then when I won the whole thing, I really had to like second guess myself, and went and talked to my boss, and I, you know, was trying to reiterate that I'm really serious about my job and my research. This is an awesome opportunity, and, you know, there's these tax incentives.
I was going to say, yeah, it's like a 40% discount or something.
Yeah, 45% when you go by state taxes, and yeah. And, he was totally on board and really great about it, and was like, yeah, I agree with you. You should go. You know, maybe just work a couple extra weekends during the fall. And I was like, all right. And so, yeah, I came in.
He's not scheduling you a Halloween weekend, though, is he?
What's Halloween weekend? I don't get it.
On the November 9.
Which
is a long way from 6,700 entering to being in the November line. Okay. But that's...
I'm sure he can get that off if need be.
Yeah. Yeah, long story short, we decided that it would make sense to come play the main. And so it was great. Actually, my buddy, the finance professor, he had 10% of me. We swapped, and he was feeling guilty about the $111,000. And so he arranged a little party for us this weekend. So I had my siblings and a couple of poker playing buddies who had, you know, taken a couple of percent of me. We all came down here, threw a party at the Venetian, like went to the club there, and chilled by the pool on Sunday, and then I played the main event yesterday. Had a great day, ran up from 50,000 to 119,000, which is almost double average what people have.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, the structure is so amazing in the main event. It's 2-hour levels. I thought the 1-hour levels was insane, but this is 2-hour levels. So they lost about 25% of the people. So average is something like 65,000 in chips, and so I have almost 120. And it was a successful day. Again, being so deep, I didn't really want to try and 3-bet any hands or play too aggressively. I was just going back to playing post flop, playing in position, and I think that some players don't realize how deep it is, and so then they feel like they got to like bluff a bunch. And so even though I'm not playing like hardly any hands, then when you do get in there, you just sort of hold on, and you can just chip up slowly without really risking your tournament life. And so it was a great day.
So has your strategy for this tournament changed versus the Monsters set?
I think that I'm going to try to be even more patient than I was in the monster stack, just because you have the 2-hour levels instead of the 1-hour levels. I guess I also just feel a little bit more comfortable and confident, sort of going back to some of our earlier conversation about, you know, you get better by going through the whole process. And so I feel good, you know, reading people at the table and just trying to make good decisions for small pots instead of play massive pots and increase the variance.
Now, have you had any... what should I call them, stars at your table? I mean, have you had to play across from Phil Ivey or anybody like that?
There's not a whole lot of people like that.
No, not a lot.
There are a lot of famous names, but not a whole lot like Phil Ivey.
In the Monster Stack, I played against some pretty big names. I was with TJ Cloutier for a couple of tables. David Phan made the final table and knocked him out.
Anybody you were really intimidated by?
I get a little bit more nervous by like the young foreign pros that are like super aggressive and you never know what they have. Some of the older like classic name pros are, I think you have a better sense of sort of in general where they're at, whereas the young pro could be just anywhere, and you know, so I think that's harder to play against. I have a pretty tough table tomorrow. I was looking up all the players before I came over here. And the guy that got second in the main event last year is at my table, but he's really short in chips. I guess it's sort of an average table. I'll be the chip leader at my table tomorrow. But all six guys on my left have, you know, at least a couple hundred thousand dollars in career earnings.
Yeah, but I read somewhere that you had a million in career earnings. But they've never heard of you. So now, given that this is going to air on day 4 or something of the event, you clearly don't want to give us your announce your strategy for the last. But we're a long way from starting day 2 seed.
And the way the way he plays could change a lot in 2 days too if he's still there, right? So I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess by that time, we'll probably be a little bit shallower in terms of stacks. So right now, I still have 200 big blinds, which is crazy after a full 10 hours of poker. And when you get shallower, you just can't make as many creative plays and just play a little bit more straightforward. But yeah, I don't try and do – I think I think the mistake that better players, like way better players than I make, are just trying to be like too active and trying to win every hand. Again, I'm like perfectly happy making small mistakes and losing small hands as long as I don't try and be a genius and lose a large hand for no reason.
Now, when you won the Monster Stack and then played two back-to-back bridge tournaments, these were, did your wife or girlfriend give you any, did she feel neglected during this time? Because obviously you were not paying her any attention at all. Or is she understanding on these things?
Well, being a single guy, I didn't have that concern.
Oh, you don't have a girlfriend?
No. That would change a lot if you just won $1 million.
having a 12...
A few more girls have been reaching out and, hey, how are you?
A 12-inch bankroll really helps. okay. So there was no special girl to feel neglected. All right. Well.
Hey, for $1 million, they can get over it, right?
Well, I don't know.
My wife would. She wouldn't have any problem at all if I was gone for 10 days or whatever, I come home with $1 million.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to do some commercials now. We were talking to Mitch Towner. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In July, they're giving away $600,000 in casino-wide progressives. The big progressive starts at $10,000 and must be hit before $25,000. Every player actively playing when the jackpot goes off receives $25 in free play. Second progressive begins at $1,000 and must be hit by $2,500. This is estimated to be hit three times daily. The new semester of free video poker classes will begin Wednesday, August 10th, and go through early October. This time, they'll be held in the Silverado Lounge, which is as soon as you enter the casino from the parking garage. At the Palms, from now until July 28th, they have drawings every Saturday night, 7:15, must be present to win. 20 winners share $10,000 each night. Every day, Monday through Friday, you can swipe to receive 20 free drawing tickets. PFP, play for prizes. From now until tomorrow, July 15th, you earn Walgreens gift cards. From June 18th through June 29th, you earn cash. Prizes are redeemed at a rate of 0.2%, up to $190 per day. You keep your points. In July, every Sunday, you earn double points on video poker, 10 times points on reel and video reels. On Wednesdays, 500 points earns you a free car wash. Thursday, same number of points earns you a free Brendan movie ticket. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. They updated the site in June, giving gold members more benefits. If you aren't gold, you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. Game of the week is Multi-Strike. Multi-Strike is a game where you pay for 4 lines up front. You pay the bottom line only. If you lose on that line, you're out. But if you at least get your money back on that line, which happens about half the time, you get to play the second line at double the payouts. Score on that line as well. You play the next line up at 4 times and keep winning, and you play the top line at 8x. There's a different strategy required for each line. On Wednesday, August 31st, I'll be teaching Jacks Are Better Multi-Strike at the South Point. All right.
So I just wanted to ask you about one of my heroes is Ed Thorpe. I'm just wondering if you have any desire to go into the markets at all and apply what you've learned to the biggest casino in the world.
A lot of the academic research really just suggests what you want to do is minimize your fees and don't exit after a crash. And so my investment strategies are very, very similar to that. It's just passive, diversified. I don't even really look at it. It's a pretty boring answer. But
so you have no interest in going and making the mega money that other quants go make.
It doesn't sound like he would consider himself a quant.
Yes to both of those. Yeah, I don't consider myself a quant, and I sort of like thinking about problems as opposed to, you know, being that kind of trader.
Yeah. Right, right.
All right. Have you decided where you're going to invest $1 million yet?
Well, so the other thing that I've been debating, which is what theory would dictate I should do, is, you know, what I just said, like put a whole bunch of money in, you know, passive, you know.
But total market
yeah,
indexes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not pay off my mortgage because I get a tax break on the mortgage. And then over, you know, the next 15 years of my mortgage that, you know, just be paying off, and the expected return should be higher than whatever I have to pay on the mortgage. I might be going against, I'm still debating, going against what the theory suggests, just because it would be really nice to not have a mortgage and not really worry about it.
You know, it's funny because my wife, one of her sort of dreams from the time she was small was to have a fully paid house. And I tried to explain to her, you know, that the cost of the money was so small that, you know, to be able to borrow money for 30 years at 4%, just, you know. But, you know, happy wife, happy life, you know. So, yeah, I paid off my house because
she just didn't
want to try to understand the math behind it.
And it's just nice to have that insurance policy. You never know if anything's going to go wrong. And then sort of further complicate things, it seems like the market's pretty highly priced right now. And so it's not clear really what the expected returns are for the next 5, 10, 15 years. So I don't know. I'm leaning towards just paying off the mortgage. Plus, I can max out all my other retirement from my real job. And so I still have plenty of market exposure. And that's what I'm thinking I might do.
All right.
All right. I just want to say you can get the show delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes or Stitcher or YouTube. Or you can sign up for it at gamblingwithanedge.com. And you can find an archive of every old episode at bobdancer.com.
And our guest next week is going to be a major friend of the broadcast, Bob Nersessian. In general, when he's coming on next week, we invite you to send in questions that we can ask him. Unfortunately, this time, we're going to be taping that show before we release this show. So by the time you hear this show, we will have already taped Nersessian's show. So any questions you send in will be for next time rather than this week. But Bob Nersessian, top lawyer, good friend. All right. Thank you, Mitch Towner. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.